You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our second of three podcasts on breast cancer hosted by Med Learning Group. This three-part series is titled Tailoring Treatment for Patients with Hormone Receptor Positive, HER2-Negative Metastatic Breast Cancer, Examining the Role of Current and Emerging Endocrine Therapies. The program is geared towards members of the multidisciplinary care team who manage breast cancer, including medical oncologists, advanced practice providers, and pharmacists in both academic and community settings. In this episode, we'll be talking about endocrine resistance, some of the clinical findings from emerging endocrine therapies, and how tumor mutation profiles are used to help inform treatment selection. My name is Chris, and I'll be the host of today's podcast. Joining me today is Dr. Erica Hamilton, Director of the Breast Cancer Research Program and Chair of the Breast Executive Committee at the Sarah Cannon Research Institute in Nashville, Tennessee. Dr. Hamilton has been heavily involved in clinical trials for emerging therapies in breast cancer and has been a speaker and faculty member for many educational events around the world. Dr. Hamilton, welcome to our discussion.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So just quickly introduce yourself. How long have you been a caregiver in breast cancer, and how did you end up becoming so involved in clinical trials for medical therapy?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I have been involved as a breast medical oncologist for about 14 years now at Sarah Cannon Research Institute in Nashville, Tennessee. So I think I have a little bit of a unique perspective as, we're heavily involved in research and clinical trials and advancing care, but also really serve as a community medical center, so not at our traditional academic university. I think clinical trials are incredibly important. It's really the way we've advanced all care in oncology, and so really excited and happy to be able to participate that in with my patients.
So let's start with endocrine resistance. When a patient is started on initial endocrine therapy for HR-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer, how does the body become resistant to it, and what is its impact on disease progression?
So we could spend an entire podcast probably on this topic of endocrine resistance. And really the short answer is there's a lot of reasons that can happen. So one is that simply the cancer no longer expresses the estrogen and progesterone receptor. So, a patient that we have initially classified as having a hormonally driven breast cancer is now more like a triple negative breast cancer or now has HER2. But really this isn't the most common. We know that there are some other markers of endocrine resistance. For example, ESR1 mutations arise in the presence of aromatase inhibitors, very rare to see in first-line therapy, less than 5%, but becomes very common, upwards of about 40% in second and third line. So that's a key resistance mechanism that we focused a lot of work on. And then there's a variety of other mechanisms. We know that other pathways can be involved in signaling that trump the estrogen axis. So patients can still have ER-positive disease, but really just not be sensitive to those endocrine agents. And that's a little bit harder to tease out sometimes.
So within this discussion of endocrine resistance, we start to talk about first and second generation agents, including the SERDs, or selective estrogen receptor degraders. Now, there's been a lot of research on these lately. What are some of the main differences between early agents and more recent ones in terms of advantages and disadvantages against the backdrop of endocrine resistance?
That's a great question. So our first SERD that we're all familiar with is fulvestrant. So this is intramuscularly administered. It's essentially two shots in the hip given on days 1 and day 15 in the first cycle and then monthly every 28 days thereafter. This is because it had really poor bioavailability that it has to be given intramuscularly. But as you can imagine, it's not all patients' favorite having to get shots. The advantage is that you know that they're getting the shot, so there's no issue of compliance or that type of thing. But what's really come to a lot of discussion lately are these next generation oral SERDs. So as it's relatively obvious, these are pills that patients take. They have some big advantages. They are not intramuscularly administered. We get very good concentrations in the body. They do have activity in both wild type as well as patients that have ESR1 mutations. And they come in a variety of different options, but many companies are developing these oral SERDs. We do have one that's FDA approved at this time, and that's elacestrant. That was the first randomized phase 3 data that we saw, and that's specific for patients that do have ESR1 mutations. Again, because those patients that have ESR1 mutations were found to have more benefit from elacestrant. We've also seen some randomized data from a couple other trials, imlunestrant, another oral SERD, camizestrant, which was an oral SERD. Those are not FDA approved yet, although conversations with imlunestrant are ongoing. The camizestrant is now in pivotal trials. And later in this podcast, we may talk a little bit about SERENA-6, which was the first registrational trial to report with camizestrant. And then what's particularly interesting is it's not just oral SERDs. There's a variety of other mechanisms of actions, PROTAC, CERANs, CIRCAs, and even new SERMs, which are more commonly thought of drugs like tamoxifen.
Well, it's definitely a pretty rich area of exploration, as you say. So switching gears a little bit, how does assessing a patient's molecular mutation profile fit into all of this? What are you looking at, and how does it drive initial and subsequent choice of some of these therapies?
So this is really something that's changed over the past decade. We used to think about kind of molecular profiling tumors for clinical trials or, you know, looking at rare mutations, not, you know, actionable for everyone in breast cancer. And that's very much not the case now. This is actionable mainly in the second line setting. So after patients have received an aromatase inhibitor in combination with CDK4/6 inhibitors, but we're looking at a variety of things. Certainly not endocrine resistance things such as PARP inhibitors and BRCA alterations. That's one thing that we're looking for. But we're also looking for these ESR1 mutations, which tell us that patients may be more likely to have good responses to a drug like an oral SERD or an oral PROTAC. And we're also looking for PI3 kinase mutations, including AKT now, as well as P10 with the approval of capivasertib, as well as now alpelisib for PI3 kinase mutations. So there's a variety of things we're looking for, and they are not rare. Again, ESR1 mutations quite common in breast cancer, up to about 40%. And then we know PI3 kinase mutations are also quite common as well.
So when a patient progresses, when a patient's disease progresses on a given therapy, talk about the impact of this treatment resistance and loss of effectiveness on patient outcomes and quality of life. What are some of the mental and physical tolls on a patient when they find that a treatment doesn't work or no longer works?
It's a fantastic question. You know, for a lot of patients, even, you know, just having progression is incredibly disheartening. I mean, maybe imagine being told that you have metastatic cancer and this is incurable. Kind of each time that your cancer doesn't respond to something, it's a big letdown, and it's very worrisome for patients. So, you know, progression can definitely have mental impacts for our patients. In terms of physical tolls, most of the time that's really due to the progression itself. You know, maybe new bone lesions or something that's causing the patient pain, more fatigue, anorexia, lack of appetite, etc. But we know that, you know, as much as we can control disease and prevent progression, that our patients in general feel better for longer.
So as we alluded to earlier in the talk, in the discussion here, I want to talk a little bit about the most recent ASCO conference, which occurred in June of 2025. So about, you know, a few weeks ago as of this recording. What are some of the clinical trial results that came from this conference? And I know there's a ton, but what's a brief summary of some of the main clinical trial results that came from this conference with regard to hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative cancer treatment?
Yeah, brief summary for this topic is a little bit challenging, luckily, because ASCO 2025 was really a big year for breast. We saw a lot of studies, a lot of advances here. A couple just to touch on, we did see some data from the NATALEE trial. This was our trial that's been previously reported. It's FDA approved adjuvant ribociclib for patients that are higher risk ER positive breast cancer in the adjuvant setting. And what we saw was kind of a analysis by menopausal status and age. And to quickly summarize this is that the benefit was really consistent across age groups. We know that our older patients are more likely to have dose reductions and discontinuations, but that all of our patients really are benefiting from that. So ribociclib definitely joins abemaciclib for our higher risk patients in the early setting. When we move over to the metastatic setting, we heard some other updates as well. A NAVO 120 is really the exception to profiling being actionable in the second line setting. This was a first line trial, but specifically for patients that had relapsed within close proximity to their adjuvant aromatase inhibitor within 12 months that looked at the addition of a inavolisib, a PI3 kinase inhibitor, in the first line setting. So a triplet where patients were receiving fulvestrant, palbociclib, a CDK4/6 inhibitor, and inavolisib. And we did see improvement in overall survival and update to that trial at ASCO. Additionally, Ember-3 is one of these oral SERDs that we just touched on. We recently saw data from this trial looking at, had three arms, essentially both an imlunestrant alone arm and then also an imlunestrant plus abemaciclib. So a strategy of continued CDK after CDK progression, but a switch of agents. The majority of those patients really had seen palbociclib or ribociclib in the first line setting. And we saw some patient reported outcomes really that our patients are feeling better and doing better when they received imlunestrant. Interestingly, the imlunestrant data was, the benefit was really restricted to those with ESR1 mutations when we looked at single agent, but when we looked at the combination of imlunestrant and abemaciclib, our benefit was all comers. You did not have to have an ESR1 mutation to benefit there. The last two trials that I'll mention are novel endocrine agents, VERITAC-2, which was vepdegestrant versus fulvestrant. In the second line setting, 100% of patients had already seen AI and CDK4/6 inhibitor, and we saw improvement in progression-free survival with vepdegestrant, again, in that subset of patients that had ESR1 mutation. So this is under discussion at regulatory authorities. This was the first disclosure of this data. And then another trial with the first disclosure of data was SERENA-6, an oral SERD, camizestrant. And this I like to call maybe line 1.5. So this was for patients that were on an AI and CDK4/6 in the first line setting, and they did not have progression, but they had the emergence of an ESR1 mutation, our known resistance mechanism. And so at that point, they were randomized either to stay on their AI with the CDK or to switch to camizestrant with that same CDK. And as expected, patients that switched to camizestrant did much better with longer PFS and longer PFS2. A lot of questions that study raises really around how we may be benefiting these patients long-term by switching therapies in the absence of progression and whether this is a strategy that we really should be employing across the board at this point.
Well, thanks, Dr. Hamilton, for that rundown. I'm sure you could have spent probably another 20 minutes or an hour on what's new and emerging in the area since it's such a quickly and richly evolving area of breast cancer treatment. But let's end on this. In the last several years, there seemed to have been an explosion of clinical trials for medical therapies, as we mentioned and as you discussed. So talk about the importance of using these agents to prolong the pre-chemotherapy window for patients. How important is it to delay chemotherapy as long as possible for these patients with breast cancer?
Yeah, that's such a fantastic point. You know, our patients in general, and we always have to say in general because there's always exceptions, but you know, their quality of life is really tends to be quite good on endocrine agents. These are pills. These are taken at home. They don't tend to cause hair loss. They're not having to come to an infusion center and have a port and get IV chemotherapy, et cetera. So patients really do prefer to be on therapies, you know, that aren't cytotoxic therapies if they can. So I think this is really why we're really excited about these agents. Our challenge is really picking out which patients are most appropriate for these. ESR1 has certainly emerged as a biomarker that can be important, but we know that there's a lot of patients that don't have an ESR1 that still can get benefit. So really kind of figuring out if we have an assay or some type of risk stratification of who should go on to continue to get further endocrine therapies is really important. And I love the fact that you highlighted the importance of clinical trials. The breast cancer field is just changing so fast. Unlike pediatric oncology or cancer in kids, where almost everyone participates in a clinical trial. In adult oncology, unfortunately, that's not the case. And these clinical trials are really how we advance care. I think there's a lot of misnomers from the olden days of what a clinical trial is, a lot of misnomers about maybe getting a sugar pill or placebo that really doesn't happen in clinical trials today. You're kind of guaranteed to it. Least get standard of care, but a lot of times a newer agent that's better than the standard of care or a newer agent in combination with the standard of care. So definitely important for us to discuss clinical trials with our patients and really answer people's questions about these.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Hamilton. Based on our discussion and based on what you do, the multitude of clinical trials and new agents is just amazing. I know you're involved in a lot of these trials, and thank you very much for all of your work that you do in this area to bring more treatment options to women with breast cancer. But that's all the time we have today. Thank you, Dr. Hamilton, again, for taking time out of your day to speak with us. And thanks to all of our listeners for joining us. Hopefully you're able to tune into the other podcasts in this series in which we'll explore additional topics in breast cancer. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our educational grant supporter, Lily, who provided an unrestricted educational grant for this activity. Thank you very much, and have a great day.